Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast and part two of the Penobscot Expedition series. If you have not listened to part one, I recommend it, although it is not required. And so I'll dive right in. So as news of General McLean's occupation of Bragadeau's Island up in Maine, which was then part of the Massachusetts colony, filtered its way back to Boston in late June or so of 1779, the Massachusetts Board of War decided that it was smart to send a combined Army-Navy task force, although they wouldn't have called it that back then, to drive off the British before they could finish building their fort. So, you know, smart. The Board of War recommended to the Massachusetts legislature that they gather every available armed ship and vessel and set sail in just 6 days. They also recommended that the government do some combination of compel and pay the private armed vessels, aka privateers, to join the expedition. And so, in my opinion, the general plan of striking before the British could become entrenched is tactically sound. But 6 days to assemble all of the ships, all of the manpower, all of the logistics, plus do all of the planning for a large expedition made up of units that had never worked together before, and all of this without modern communications, where coordination happened at the speed of horseback, 6 days? 6 days? There is a balance between striking fast and doing the bare minimum amount of necessary planning not to have the expedition turn into an unorganized clusterfuck. And with this level of genius strategic planning from the get-go, you might begin to understand how this expedition ended up a complete loss as the American force burned their own ships to avoid capture, and thousands of men fled south in a disorganized rout through hundreds of miles of Maine backwoods in the biggest American disaster pre-Pearl Harbor. But nonetheless, obvious flaws ignored, the Massachusetts legislature accepted the Board of War's recommendation to launch in 6 days. And for this expedition, ships were drawn from every available source. The Continental Navy provided three ships, including the 32-gun frigate Warren, which served as a flagship and the biggest source of firepower for the expedition. And during the Revolutionary War, 11 of the 13 rebelling colonies maintained state navies, and so Massachusetts devoted all available ships to the expedition, and neighboring New Hampshire kicked in a 22-gun impressed privateer for the assault as well. And so here I'm going to go into a small aside on privateering during the Revolutionary War, which I definitely want to do a full episode on at some point. But the rest of the force for the Penobscot expedition, in fact, the majority of the force, was drawn from the large privateering fleet that had flourished as British trade became fair game. I talked about the privateering very briefly in some past episodes, but the way it essentially worked was that the government gives private citizens the right to attack enemy shipping, subject to certain restrictions. This was distinguished from piracy, at least in the eyes of the people doing the privateering, if not the people subject to it, because privateers could only attack ships of certain countries that their government authorized. They had to abide by some basic rules of civility and not wantonly torture, rape, murder, and sell the crew of captured ships into slavery, as pirates then and still are like to do. These privateers also had to split the value of the captured ship and cargo with the government, which authorized the privateering in the first place. And so, for the most part, privateering was a really powerful tool in the Revolutionary War for the Americans, and later in the War of 1812 as well. Privateering is a traditional weapon of weaker powers who can't go toe-to-toe with stronger powers afloat. Privateering is a form of guerrilla warfare at sea, and just like all forms of guerrilla warfare, it is exponentially harder and more expensive to defend against this guerrilla warfare than carry it out. And so privateering essentially mustered the entrepreneurial spirit of the rich to finance and arm the seafaring to go plunder the ships of a nation's enemies, in this case, the revolutionary United States' enemy, Britain. And Britain had the biggest trade fleet in the world at the time, so there were a lot of great targets. This brought in money, this brought in badly needed supplies from the captured ships, and just as importantly, it cost the enemy, the British in this case, a lot of money in the form of lost ships and cargo, which in turn created a powerful lobbying force back in the capital of the larger power, so London, for ending the war so that everybody could go back to making money. The primary downside of the privateering effort, at least in the Revolutionary War, was that it diverted the finite seagoing resources of ships and sailors and other supplies from a central coordinated action and disperse them to whatever ends the privateers found most profitable. In the case of revolutionary America, this tendency to seek out the profitable path of privateering rarely meant a toe-to-toe fight with the formidable Royal Navy. And so when the call went out for privateers in New England to assemble for an expedition to attack a British fort in Maine, there were very few takers because British forts were not particularly known for their looting potential. And they were known for their ability to fight back, obviously. And so despite the state of Massachusetts' offer to pay for all the expedition's expenses and a fee to essentially rent out the privateer ships, the owners and the captains were not generally interested. Eventually, the state of Massachusetts got tired and desperate with the days ticking by, and 12 privateers were eventually involuntarily impressed into service for a 2-month term that the expedition was expected to take. Now that the ships were secured, the second problem of manpower and supplies presented itself. In those sailing days, the civilian sailor and the naval sailor needed and possessed a pretty similar skill set, and they often switched back and forth between ships after a cruise contract was up. Today, this is very much not the case, because Navy sailors spend most of their working hours operating, training on, and doing maintenance on military equipment, which often does not have a particularly close civilian counterpart. And so the skill sets are pretty distinct. But in 1779, that wasn't the case. And a lot of civilian sailors could theoretically go fight as naval sailors with very little skill differentiation. However, very few of these sailors wanted to join the expedition. The chance of being compelled to extend service indefinitely in the Continental Navy was not welcome, but effectively there were also lower wages on offer for military service, because on a privateering ship, the crew got a small part of whatever prize, you know, whatever British loot they were able to capture. And so that created a big incentive for the experienced sailor to try their best to avoid the roving press gangs looking for able-bodied seamen for this expedition. But just as pressing as the manpower, a navy is an incomprehensibly complex organization that eats supplies at a pace with few parallels. Rope, wood, tar, food, gunpowder, cannons, sailcloth, nails, and just about every other conceivable war good was in short supply. And the state of Massachusetts ended up seizing the required goods and then paying what they considered a fair market rate rather than allow vital war goods to be subject to a bidding war that was getting pretty feverish with the buildup of ships in Boston Harbor. And so all of this naval preparation did not, to say the least, come together in 6 days. In fact, it took more than a month, but nonetheless, it did come together, and as the ships and supplies began to flow into Boston Harbor, the public support and excitement for the expedition grew pretty high. But if the process of assembling a fleet was poorly coordinated, the process of assembling the land force that in theory would drive the British General McLean and his troops off of their fort, this process was somehow even worse. The state of Massachusetts was so confident that their expedition would succeed that they did not bother to tell the Continental Army General Horatio Gates in neighboring Rhode Island at the time about the expedition, or ask for any Continental Army troops. The Massachusetts leadership deliberately kept George Washington and the Continental Congress in the dark about the pending expedition to Maine, because they believed that, quote, if but 10 Continental soldiers are concerned, the continent will take all of the honor. Real great way to prosecute a war. So instead of launching the Penobscot expedition with full-time soldiers who were now veterans of 4 years of hard warfare, Massachusetts relied on their militia. And to be fair, some of these militiamen were also veterans at this point, but they were also, by definition, part-time soldiers. And many of these part-time soldiers proved a little bit, and by that I mean a lot bit, reluctant to muster for the expedition. Every town in Massachusetts was given a quota of men to fill for the expedition. And when that still did not produce enough volunteers, it became what we in the Navy like to call voluntold. Soldiers were sent out to the towns short on their quota and they started assembling a landing force by any means necessary. In the words of a Major Hill, who led one of these enforcement groups, quote, "Some were taken and brought by force. Some were frightened and joined voluntarily, and some skulked and kept themselves concealed." So Major Hill and, you know, some other groups, they tried to round up the soldiers that they needed. But of the soldiers that did join the expedition, it doesn't seem like any particular village was eager to send their best. The same Major Hill summed up the soldiers sent as, quote, "boys, old men, and invalids. If they belonged to the train band or alarm list, they were soldiers, whether they could carry a gun, walk a mile without crutches, or only compos mendis, aka sanity, sufficient to keep themselves out of fire and water." In other words, instead of Continental Army soldiers, the expedition landing force was being manned with the dregs of the Massachusetts State Militia, which, even after being forced to volunteer, were found by one of the expedition's generals to be, quote, "one-fourth part, small boys, old men, and unfit for service," end quote. And still, despite all of that, accepting the small boys, old men, and the insane and the unfit for service, they were still 500 short of the planned 1,500 men in the landing force that the expedition planned to embark with. But nonetheless, the men were loaded up on 21 transports waiting in Boston Harbor. And so now, with the men and ships assembled, some 3 weeks after the initial ridiculous six-day timeline, the fleet left Boston Harbor on July 24th, 1779. In command of the naval aspect was the well-regarded Commander Saltonstall of the Continental Navy, who led a force of 3 Continental Navy ships, 3 from the Massachusetts State Navy, and 12 armed privateers, all powered by a combination of sails and oars, which would be vital to any river warfare in the Penobscot Bay. The landing force aspect of the expedition was led by General Lavelle, with Colonel Paul Revere, yes, that Paul Revere, leading the artillery. But wait. You might have just noticed that I did not mention who was in overall command of the expedition, just that there was a naval and a land commander. And that would be because there was no overall commander. Yep, as amazing and stupid as that sounds from the perspective of an era soaked in the mantra of joint operations, aka today, there was no overall commander of the expedition. General Lavelle could not force Commander Saltonstall to do anything he didn't want to do, and Commander Saltonstall could not force General Lavelle to do anything that he did not want to do either. There was a total reliance on the cooperation and agreement of the two services to work together on what they mutually considered and agreed was the best course of action. And perhaps, dear listener, given your knowledge of the pending disaster, you can foresee how this was going to be a problem down the road. But for that, you're going to have to wait for the next episode. For now, the summary that historian Georgie Bunker, whose book on the Penobscot Expedition I am relying on for a lot of the research in this podcast, sums up the situation pretty well when he says, quote, "The Penobscot Expedition made an impressive sight, yet looks were deceiving. The militia lacked a third of its scheduled numbers. The militiamen came together as a unit the day before departing. The expedition's armed vessels were equally poorly prepared for the task at hand. And finally, the two commanders and their staffs failed to arrive at a common strategy at their first meeting. This did not bode well for the expedition." And that is a pretty accurate summary. The next episode will be out in a few days. Until then, I have a new website, usnavalhistory.com, that has an option to donate. I want to give a big thanks to my first donor, Nate D. I get a little email notification when someone donates. So far, I admit I've only had one, but when that notification came in, I was extremely relieved because I had no idea if anyone at all liked the podcast enough to donate. So thank you again, Nate. And if anyone else wants to donate, the link is in the podcast show description as well as on the website, usnavalhistory.com. You can also sign up for the 100% free newsletter there, comment on posts which accompany each podcast episode, and of course, you can also send me an email at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.